We are now in the 8th installment of this series, where we have discovered and explored fake news again 1 year later, civility in America, censorship in America, what monuments mean, the literary landscape of Montana, and the politics of food. Almost 1,200 people have attended these events. My hope, or the goal of this series, is to stimulate critical thinking, and hopefully you guys will further that conversation once you leave here tonight. My hope is that when you leave here, you'll share what you've learned, because I'm sure you will learn something. I would like to thank Yellowstone Public Radio for recording tonight's program. For those of you who have attended other programs in this series, you will notice that we are experimenting with the format. Normally we have the panelists up there and we have a slide and everything else. Well, tonight we have a one-man show. Tonight's program is a joint effort between the Billings Public Library and the Congregation Beth Aaron. I would like to thank Mr. Yuri Barnea, Chair of the Special Events Committee at Beth Aaron, for bringing this idea to fruition. Mr. Barnea will introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Jonathan Elderman. What we will do tonight is it will be an hour-long lecture, and then we'll have about a half-hour Q&A. At that time, when it is time for the Q&A, I ask as one question per person, and make sure the question doesn't have five parts to it, please. So, Mr. Barnea?
Thanks very much, Gavin, for the collaboration between Congregation Beth Aaron and the library. I had the pleasure and the distinction of hearing Dr. Edelman about, I think, 6 or 7 years ago when I was still in Mississippi, and I can assure you, you are here for a real treat. Dr. Edelman is an encyclopedia walking on two as far as the Middle East is concerned, Russia and China, and it's possible that he will touch about this too. His curriculum or his resume is very long, and I'd rather you hear him than me, so I'll just do it in brief. He got his 3 degrees, undergraduate, master's, and PhD at Columbia in New York. His specialty research and expertise is comparison politics, history of the Soviet Union, Russian foreign and defense policies, Chinese national security and defense policies. He's a professor at the Joseph Corbell Study of International Studies at the University of Denver, been there for over 30 years in this position, also a senior fellow, the Foundational Defense of Democracies in Washington, visiting professor, Central European University in Budapest, and People's University in Beijing, honorary professor also, was on 17 lecture tours to China in the last 15 years, 15 international speaking tours for the State Department in 13 countries, also a frequent speaker on Israel and the Middle East, over 440 national speaking tours between 2002 and 2016, author or editor of 12 books and 92 op-ed articles. It's really a pleasure to welcome Dr. Jonathan Edelman. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Edelman. The question, I think you can move to some, you know, as far as Russia. Russia is also concerned in the Middle East. The title for tonight's lecture is actually The Middle East, Realliances and Elusive Peace. So that's a big topic. Thank you.
Okay, it's a privilege to be here. I must confess that while I have traveled a little bit, I've never been to Montana, so there's always things in your life that you wish you had done. So what we're going to talk about today is a region of the world that is in transition. One can make the argument that almost everybody in the world is in transition, or every geographic part is. You can look at Russia, for example, and you can see that we had 74 years of the Soviet Union and communism, and then suddenly we had an intermission for 10 years, and now we have Vladimir Putin. And so when you look at Vladimir Putin, what's fascinating about him is that he lives in a country that has shrunk enormously. They used to have 300 million people in 15 provinces, and now they have, instead of 300 million, they have 143 million people, and they shrunk by 2.5 million square miles. So what do you do in that particular situation? And it's very simple. If you're Vladimir Putin, you don't give up all of the wonderful ways, okay, I'm being sarcastic, the wonderful ways to deal with the opposition. Can you imagine Americans thinking, oh, there is a way we can take care of those other people. But what's fascinating is what he came up with. And what he came up with, or rather probably the people Sergei Lavrov, the foreign ministry leader, they came up with something really interesting, if a little barbaric. And it was the notion that we're not going to admit that we shouldn't be 300 million people. And we're going to go back to Tsarist Russia, which after all died in February 1917. And we're going to slowly, so that the West doesn't even notice what we're doing. You know, it's almost the exact opposite of aggressive moves. We're going to go into a place like Georgia, or if you're Russian, it's Gruzia. And when the road, as I was just talking before I came here, when the road to Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, was open, the Red Army, the Russian Army, didn't take it. Instead, they went to Abkhazia. And how many people in this room know what is Abkhazia in the Russian world? Putin was betting on that nobody knows. But Abkhazia is very well known to Russians because Abkhazia is the playground of a man who is a hero to 47% of Russians, otherwise known as Joseph Stalin or Yosef Djugashvili, if you want his Georgian name. And it illustrates an incredible turnaround. Since under Stalin, millions of innocent people were killed or sent to Siberia, but now he is a hero in Russia to the next generation. Why? Because he did those things which even the West couldn't do, and that was, in their minds, defeated Nazi Germany, even at a stunningly high cost, an incredible cost. The best estimate, it used to be 20 million Russians died. Now the estimates are 25 to 27 million Russians were slaughtered. 7 million on the field of battle, 3 million who were taken prisoner, thinking that if they put up their hands, this was the Germany of World War I, they would be treated decently. And instead, they were dead before the week or two was out on forced marches in wintry weather. And the rest, you're looking at 15, 17 million innocent civilians. But if you ask the Russians what is the most important thing that happened in the 20th century, they would say that what was the great victory over Adolf Hitler and seizing Berlin. In other words, the Russians have definitely been in for the visual, and that is important even to the next generation. And the situation is so powerful to have that kind of people, almost as if you had a Holocaust, but now extending over the Russian people to lose 17 million dead outside of the field of battle, that he is able to go back and say he was our great hero. And many Russians agree for a reason that Americans would bridle at, which was Americans didn't win the war. We won the war. Look at the number of casualties, Russians will tell you. 292,000 dead, and we lost 27 million dead. We lost 100 times more than the Americans lost in World War II. And they didn't have occupation of their territory, and we had 600,000 square miles occupied by Nazi Germany. And that is meant also to be a prelude to what we're going to discuss today. And you say, what are we going to talk about? And what we're going to talk about is what's going to develop in the Middle East today, because it is very complex, it is extremely confusing. But it's also important to realize that very often things don't develop the way they logically should. In other words, logic is very powerful. But if you look at it, the Germans could easily have won World War I or World War II. In World War I, in the spring of 1918, the German army was only 55 miles from Paris. Had they taken, and they had four offenses at that time, had they taken that possibility to go and seize Paris, the French would clearly, as they did in World War II, in April and May of 1940, when they were occupied by the Germans, the French would have declared the end of the war, set up their own separate government, and proceeded on their merry way. What would then have happened? What would have happened, to ask a simple question, if the kind of offensive that the German army, the Luftwaffe and the Wehrmacht, were able to mount very early on in the war after their invasion of Russia in June 22, 1941, that they got within 50 miles of major cities, and in the case of Moscow, which is by far the most important city, both realistically and symbolically, they were at the airport. You can see it yourself when you go to Moscow and you fly in there. It's 15 miles from there to the end. And the Russians were making preparations to depart from Moscow. They didn't think they could hold out. And the same thing is true with Stalingrad, where the Germans occupied 90% of Stalingrad before they finally were beaten back, and Leningrad, where the battling was so fierce. How many civilians were killed in the battle for Leningrad? Anybody know? What? Yeah, excellent. 1 million. 1 million people in a battle. One time when I was looking for a babysitter for my son, I knew we had some Russian immigrants living in Denver, and I asked them to come along, and I said, what was that like? Because they had been in Leningrad for the first 4 months. And he said it was unbelievable, because every day in the winter, you would see dead people lying there in the street, their relatives coming to look at them and to pick them up, and they couldn't even give them a burial because the ground was so frozen and it was so cold. And Americans have a hard time thinking that geography and weather have anything to do with it. But actually, it's often extremely powerful influence. A few weeks ago, Siberia set a new record in the kind of temperature. We all know it's very warm. It was minus 88 degrees centigrade. And so, given all of that, and given that in the three major battles of the first year of the war, in Leningrad, in Stalingrad, and in Moscow, the Germans came this close to victory, and they even would have gotten closer if Adolf Hitler had not been so stupid as to think that he was some godlike figure who always got it right, like some of our politicians do today. It's a country called America. You wouldn't be interested. So what is powerful is that when we look, and what we're trying to say is, when we try to divine what's going to happen in the Middle East, it's important to remember that many cases in the past came extremely close, and what decided it was something which wasn't even considered a factor. What was powerful in 1941, which just stopped the Germans this close to final victory in the war, was very simple. They were supposed to, the Wehrmacht and Luftwaffe, start attacking Russia on May 2nd. But there were problems in Greece and some of the other would-be colonies. And as a result, Hitler thought, it won't matter. We'll delay it until the 22nd of July. And the reality to that was total disaster, because if they had that extra 6 weeks, I mean, it's June 22nd, then they would have broken into Leningrad, into Moscow, and into Stalingrad. Now you may say, but the Russian people were going to fight. Not so much, because they didn't know what Adolf Hitler was all about. They didn't know what that would mean for the destruction of millions and tens of millions of people, because that hadn't happened yet. Or at least then it just began to happen. The Russian army had not made a comeback to be able to witness what that looked like. So what was powerful was that because of that six-week delay in attacking, what could have been an outright German victory, and at that, if you look at what that would have meant for the United States, it is that we wouldn't have been able to continue. Because, and I'm not saying this alone, this is what kind of the majority sentiment is about this, and for a very simple reason. The British were quite ready to give up, despite Winston Churchill's best efforts we have to remember that there was great concern in England because of the high cost of World War I, and because they knew their land power was not very good compared to their sea power. So if the Russians threw up their hands and quit, and the Americans were really not yet in the war at this particular time, they wouldn't be in the war for another 6 months. Not because they wanted to be, but because of Pearl Harbor. But more importantly, my father fought in World War II, so we had some first-hand discussion about this. His point was very simple. We weren't ready in 1942, even in 1943. He said in 1943, we're now talking about a lengthy period of time, like almost a year and a half after the Russians would have been invaded by the Germans, that he said in his unit, the 86th Blackhawks Division, that most of the men, and this is as late as early 1943 already, most of the men were totally unprepared to fight. They had no background whatsoever, because we had, in January of 1939, we had only 12,000 officers in the American Army. And even if you wanted to include the National Guard units and you wanted to include the reservists, we had 300,000 soldiers. The Germans had 4 million. So it took the Americans a couple of years before they were fully ready for action. You may remember their first action was in the fall of 1942. And did they go head-to-head with the Germans? No, they didn't dare. Why? Where did they go? Where in the fall of 1942, together with the British, did they win the first Allied victory of the war? Exactly. The North Africa campaign, in which they were facing, at best, 6 German divisions out of 300. So if the war had gone the other way early, the Americans were absolutely not prepared. We didn't have nuclear weapons yet. Manhattan Project was just getting off the ground, thanks to Albert Einstein, and would take several years to reach. And we had to get, as much as we were immune because of 3,000 miles of ocean, they were also immune from us. So the British would have given in. And the result is the United States would have had to face not only a Nazi-dominated, German-dominated world, but one in which Imperial Japan was busily taking over China. Over 200 million Chinese lived under them. And they slaughtered their version of the Holocaust. They slaughtered 20 to 30 million innocent people, civilians. They burned down 900 villages and just killed all the people within it. So what's powerful as we look at the Middle East today is we shouldn't be too sure that we know what's going to happen, because sometimes very little things can make a huge difference. But several things are clear. For Russia, this has been a great victory. Now, when it first happened after the Arab Spring in 2011, after the Arab Spring, what was powerful here was that everyone assumed, including myself, that the Russians wouldn't be able to win because they were far away from home. This was an area that being Russian Orthodox would mean absolutely nothing. And Russia was very weak in its navy. In fact, if you ask a question today, if we ask outside of Russia itself, how many bases does Russia have for its kind of modest fleet to actually use on a regular basis? And the answer was zero, whereas the Americans have up to 500, because we have many allies in Europe, in Asia, the Japanese, and the Koreans, and these days even the Indians would be on our side, would have no problem. So let's dissect what's going on in the Middle East. First of all, it surprised everybody because people just assumed that Bashar al-Assad was going to go the way of whom? Two other leaders were killed. And Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. So the assumption was Bashar al-Assad, who was not liked, and furthermore had no... Okay, let's just give the back 2011 view of all this stuff. And furthermore, he himself was not fit as a politician. You ever watch him talk? He actually went to school in London, but he didn't study politics. What did he study? Ophthalmology. The front row gets it right every time. Okay. So what's your names? Okay, there you go. So what's powerful is, what is going on? Because people thought that this was the movement for Arab democracy. And instead, what we've gotten is victory for the radical Islamic faction, particularly out, of course, of Iran. And they have seen this as a great effort. Every Friday morning, at the beginning of services, they call for death to the United States and death to Israel. And they've said this hundreds and hundreds of times. I'm sure to this level, they would certainly admit that they were totally right. And what's powerful is that there is deep concern in Washington and elsewhere that they may be able to carry through what they want, because they have made strong alliances, like with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And who is it going to be with in Yemen, for example? What? No, local radical forces. The Houthis. Okay, these are the Shiite forces, exactly. The Shiite forces in the region. So as you go around the region, you see the arc that has developed for Shiites. So an arc in Iraq, which is 60% Shiite, an arc in Iran, which is about 80% Shiite, then in Yemen, I'm not sure the exact number, but it's substantial. Right now, the Houthis control the capital and about 20% of the rest of the country, and most of all, Hezbollah. But you say, why is this a big problem? The military record of the Iranians is not very impressive. In fact, it's so bad that you would think we should not even worry about it. Because we saw the Iranian army in battle against whom in the 1980s for 8 years? Iraq. Do we consider Iraq to be a major military capability? Not at all. And they were unable to destroy the Iraqis in the field of battle. So let's say the Iraqis maybe are 30th or 40th in rating. Therefore, there shouldn't be anything that much serious about Iran. But the problem with that thinking is that things change. And the Iranians have done several things that some people have paid attention to and others have not. One, of course, is their nuclear program. And their nuclear program is much better than they themselves could do. Because, let's face it, they started in 1985. And here we are 30 years later. And they still don't display a nuclear weapon. But that's kind of almost like false bravado. There's a problem with that. And what's the problem with that? The problem is they work with other countries, and specifically with South Korea. They work with South Korea, and who else do they work with? North Korea, of course, sorry. North Korea, and what else? And Russia. And so their capability of getting nuclear weapons soars. So whenever you see that the North Koreans have been able to put rockets into space, you can remember that when the Israelis in 2007 attacked the Syrian nuclear program, and the Americans said, but there's no real nuclear program there. The Israelis produced a tape of North Korean scientists sitting there next and speaking in their language, had to be translated, with the Iranians. So this is something that we have to think about, not so much right now, but to think that there's something very dangerous going on when countries like North Korea and Iran can get nuclear weapons very quickly. Because if you look at them, we historically believe that most of the countries of the 9 or 10 countries, depending on how you want to count, that have nuclear weapons got them because they're advanced technologically. Ask yourself this. What has North Korea ever exported or Iran ever exported beyond oil, gas, and other things? The technically capable people, many of them, have fled the country. There's 4 to 5 million Iranians abroad, and they have done really well, contrary to what they would have done in Iran, because we know, because we can go out and see the results. They took $100 billion that this overseas Iranians have been able to amass, and how much of the money that they made and invested was invested in Iran? Zero. These are people after our own heart. They wanted Iran, which is going to be like it was, but even better than under the Shah, who now looks great compared to this from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So there's a lesson here. If you're a politician, and maybe your time in office wasn't that great, just hope the next one along is a real schlub and you don't have anything much to worry about. So we have the first problem, which is Iran, and Iran getting nuclear weapons and nuclear capability. Secondly, we see other things as well in the region. We see the influence of North Korea. And we would think, why would they have any influence? But it's the influence that comes from their devoting everything that they've got to their nuclear program, because they can also sell aspects of that internationally for billions of dollars and help them to stay afloat. But thirdly, it's very important, is that in the Middle East today, democracy has died outside of Israel. And at one time, somewhat, Lebanon was democratic or semi-democratic for a while. But that's about it among 300 million Arabs. And so what's powerful is that we have a region now in which the radical forces have been able to do very well, but also to accumulate enormous stockpiles. Hezbollah in Lebanon, how many weapons do they have? How many rockets they can aim at Israel or whoever they want? Yeah, at least 100 to 150, maybe 200,000 of them. So no matter how good you are to try to stop, and they can't all be sent off at the same time, and they used to say you get about 1,500 a day, this is a very serious matter. But there is another side to the Iran story. We've already given a hint at it, which is that much of their creative class has emigrated abroad. And I've talked to some of them too, and they are absolutely disgusted by what's going on in Iran today. But what's even more important to remember is that the Iranian people are also disgusted for a very simple reason. They look at the high technical capability, which is now being devoted with help from other countries, and say, why is our standard of living so pathetic? And if you take the whole Iranian population and you look at the GDP per capita, let's take the United States first. What is the GDP, the gross domestic product, per person in the United States? Roughly. Almost $60,000. So when you add that up, it's about $19 trillion going on $20 trillion. So we're at 60,000, and the Iranians are somewhere around 7,000. We are almost 10 to 1 over them. So for the United States, there's many issues. How much to get involved? We have an administration that has been slow to develop its foreign policy. You just saw that. They removed Rex Tillerson. And now who's going to be the Secretary of State if he's approved by Congress, by the Senate? Okay. What's his first name? Mike Pompeo. So, and this is not atypical of most new administrations. It must be very difficult for anyone who was a congressman or a senator or a businessman or whatever to shift into a very difficult situation about which you're responsible for what goes on in the entire world. So the second thing is that Syria is now divided in thirds. One third of Syria is controlled by pro-Western forces, mostly Kurds, who, on the other hand, we don't fight to protect. It's very interesting. But they're fighting because they want to have Kurdistan. And they were promised that back in 1919, and they didn't get it. And so 100 years later, they still want it. There's 37 million Kurds. Biggest number of them is in what country? No, Turkey. 17 million are in Turkey. So this leads to the next issue. And the next issue is, if Iran is both very strong and very weak at the same time and has major domestic problems. It had the whole Green Movement in 2008. It had uprising in the countryside only a few months ago. And that was very interesting because the Green Movement was led by the old power elite, and the Green Movement attracted hundreds of thousands of people in the urban areas. What we saw in demonstration a few months ago was the countryside, hundreds of little towns and villages, which shows that there is a problem on the other side. And we're going to sketch it because it doesn't just exist in Iran. In a free and open election, which they're not going to have, in Iran, they had 800 candidates to be the leader of the country, and 795 of them were banned from getting started. Imagine if they did that in the United States. So what's powerful is that it is a movement that is popular in a certain way, but it's also a movement that has several aspects which are going to be very difficult for them to deal with. The first one we just said, that they have a very low GDP per capita, salaries are low. Secondly, the majority of the Iranian population is below 30. And I was just having a very nice discussion with Uri before about the role that young people play. And many young people feel nobody's listening to us. But the truth is that when they're the majority of the population, the regime doesn't have a lot of choice after a while. And they are heavily disgusted with what's going on because of the capacity on the internet, even though it's partially blocked. But to see how people live in the West, how people live in comfortable conditions, and where they can get a job, and that's particularly important because women especially have problems getting a job, and where they would be able to develop their own interests. Because just like in Russia, in Iran, nearly all the scientific technical work is being done by the government, which doesn't sound terrible, but when you think that in the United States, the government probably does, to throw out a guess, 10 to 20% of the work, it's Silicon Valley is kind of the mire, is kind of reflects the notion of high-tech capabilities and so forth. And yet in Iran, the great majority of people don't get it. That's one reason 5 million people have emigrated abroad. So that is one thing. They don't reflect the younger generation. We see that, by the way, in other countries. We see that in Saudi Arabia. We look at Mohammed bin Salman, the 32-year-old crown prince who's going to become the leader. And he reflects that younger generation. He's saying, sure, women should drive a car. Sure, women should head an organization. Sure, women should be able to do whatever they want to do. And the most important thing he said, because that was aimed right at Iran, was to say, and we don't want people to work 3 hours a day. We want people, which happens a lot in Saudi Arabia, we want people to be able to develop their own businesses. We like what we see in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere. That's got a lot of appeal, especially to the capable people in the next generation, rather than being appointed because of just how religious you are. He even said that, which I thought was utterly remarkable to hear that out of the Arab Muslim Middle East. He said, I don't want radical Islam. He said it, which was pretty gutsy of him, because he'd get killed for that. He said, I don't, especially Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 people that carried out 9/11 were originally from Saudi Arabia. So I'm not saying the state ordered it. They didn't. But this is clearly of interest. So what's powerful is that the Iranians don't have the technical capability outside of war. They don't. Their exports are overwhelmingly what? Oil and gas. And that's important because we saw the price of oil a few years ago go to 137, plunge to the 30s. Now, I haven't checked the last few days. It was around 60, 60, 65. So that means that the capability of the regime to carry on its way is going to be very limited because you have a growing population, and that population wants and made it clear in the street demonstrations, we want a job, we want to make a decent living, we want to be able to have some children some decade before we're 50 years old, you know, and we don't want war. That doesn't mean they're pro-Western. I want to make that clear. It doesn't necessarily mean they're pro-Western, but across the board. But it means that they listen to Western music. They hear the conversations. They have some of that translated even by other people in the region. They say, that's the kind of life that we want to have. So that's the second thing. Thirdly, there's major splits in Iran between different factions in the power elite. We see that in the difference between the foreign minister who actually we know very well because he got his PhD in our school about 5 years ago, and the prime minister. Major differences. You can see it between the old guard, which stresses the importance of being a radical Muslim and going to services 5 times a day and praying, and that's the main thing you do in your life, as opposed to the younger generation that says, that doesn't mean we don't believe in Islam, but that's not the only thing in life. That's something we could go to once a day, twice a day, but we want to be able to participate. And to do that, we've got to go international, because if we're going to go international, if we don't go international, we can't develop very well. We should need to reach out to those 5 million Iranians abroad who have hundreds of billions of dollars and have demonstrated it. We need to be able to travel abroad. And one other thing that he said was interesting. The word Israel is barely ever mentioned in Saudi Arabia. But we've had one of his assistants in the newspaper say, maybe the time has come for us to stop fighting the Israelis, because after all, they agree with some of the things that we're saying in opposition to the Iranian regime. And if there is a war, who's going to be the real loser? We are in Iran, because millions of people are going to die, and the capabilities of the regime are very limited. Finally, there's something else. It's the relationship between Iran and Russia. It's complicated, but we'll give it simply. On paper, it looks great. Russia is dominant power in Europe, especially when you look at how weak our major allies, England, France, Germany, Italy, really are. The British have announced that they're going to go down to 60,000 men. That's no more than the Saudis have in their force. And they've been wrapping up some of their bases abroad. They don't have anywhere nearly the kind of bases that they had before. The colonies are all gone, the Hong Kongs, the Singapores, you know, kind of across the world. But what's fascinating is that these countries were still vital to the United States, because we have that great advantage of being 3,000 miles away from Germany. But they are close, and much closer to the Middle East than we are. And they are generally opting out. They're not supporting the other side, but you saw it in their spending of GDP on military-related action, under 2%, even 1.5%. So they are not going to be able to fight. So what's powerful here is Russia becomes an important player. But Russia has certain weaknesses, and they've made them very clear. First of all, the Russians are not interested in all-out war. The population would not put up with that, because they know about the tens of millions of people that died in the last war. They like what Putin is doing. No casualties, almost no casualties, etc. But they have something more important. 4 years ago, the Russians decided they weren't going to sell the S-400, an anti-ballistic missile, very sophisticated one, to the Iranians. They had promised them they would, and shock, they decided not to do it. And so the Iranians, on the front page of their newspapers, ran pure condemnation of the Russians. How horrible these people are, how little they care, they never liked us, and so forth. The Russians came right back at them the next day. And they said something which got zero attention in the United States. Should have paid attention to what Moscow's saying, because sometimes, even occasionally, it's true. And just got to be able to know when that little time has come. This time, what the Russians said was very interesting. They said, I'm quoting now, in the translation into English is, we want to remind our colleagues, our comrades in Iran. Okay, that's all nonsense. But then we want to remind them of the history of the last 200 years between Tsarist Russia and the Muslim state of Iran, the the Iranian empire. Well, I don't think most Americans would do very well in the last 200 years between Moscow and Tehran. But to spare you the ignominy of not knowing something, which you may wonder is terribly important, what was powerful about that was four times in the last 200 years, most recently in 1941, together with the British, the Russian army occupied Iran. And at the end of the first decade of the 20th century, they ended the fighting there. They said, we want to remind our Iranian comrades, in other words, what they want to remind them of is you are a bunch of schlubs, and we are first world power. And we've got the nuclear weapons. We beat you four times in a row. What's also significant is the other country, Turkey. Turkey is a country very complex. I was there a couple years ago for the State Department. It was very interesting. Typically, from the 1920s on, the Turks had ended with the Turkish Empire and now tried to move towards what I call semi-democracy, become a part of NATO, participate. Their GNP per capita is $3,000 or $4,000 higher than Tehran's is because they do sell a lot in the West. And what was powerful was that the Russians also ran an article about that, just in case these little minor countries, the Iranians and the Turks, had any aspirations that the Russians would do what the hell they're going to be asked to do. They said, we'd like to remind the Turks, while we're reminding the Iranians, of the last 12 wars that we fought between the Russian Empire and the Turkish Empire, all of which we won. And that is powerful. Because what it means is, yes, the Russians are at least temporarily going along with the Iranians and the Turks, but they understand that this runs directly against other relationships that they have been building. Now, it's complex, and we could spend an hour on it, but I promise only 58 minutes. Seriously, we need to look at this because we're trying to look at it from Vladimir Putin's point of view. Granted, it's difficult to do. And granted, not everyone can do all the great physical feats that he can perform, like magic. So, and at his 60s, that's really, really impressive. But what's powerful is that despite all of that, that from Russia's point of view, these are second-rate countries. And though they're willing to go along in Syria, the problem for that is they have been developing other relationships. In Europe, they have developed a very good relationship with Angela Merkel, of all people, who's center-right. You wouldn't expect that. With Romania, with Hungary, which is hard to understand when the Russians invaded Hungary, if you remember, in 1849 and in 1956, you think that would be the last country they would be naming. But the Hungarians today, under the Fidesz party, are very pro-Russian. Even in England, if we get, God forbid, Hasbe Khalilah, if we get, instead of Theresa May, who has her problems, but nevertheless is at least reasonable, and we go to Jeremy Corbyn, he is flamingly pro-Russian, and openly that we should now, England should be recognized with them. So the Russians are looking, especially with Sergei Lavrov, their foreign minister, who does a very good job of this. I met him once. He's a very smart guy. And the way he runs the foreign ministry, I was discussing that before, is much more useful than the way that so many Americans. I'm not saying anything against the State Department, but it's run so differently than Russians, you wouldn't recognize it. In other words, in the State Department, you go, you get preparation, you go, get a two-year stay in China. I mean, it takes 5 years to be able to speak the language and to learn and get to know the people, unless you're Chinese American. So what's powerful with the Russians is that they choose, every person that comes in gets a label. It's kind of one-sided. They decide, the elite decides where you should, what country you should be focused on. And the other is, what is your particular predilection? So if you like India, they'll think about it because India's been a major ally of Russia from the get-go for 60 years. So what's powerful is that the Russians know a great deal more about the countries that they are dealing with because I was invited in once because I deal with Israel, and there were 25 people in the room, and they all asked very intelligent. You would have thought they were professional, and they were professional because they can read the language, they develop relationships, they buy places there, they know what the story is. And the reason we mention Israel is that what's fascinating about Vladimir Putin is that for the first time since Lenin, we have a leader of Russia. I was about to say the Soviet Union, because it feels like the Soviet Union sometimes, but of Russia, who actually is not anti-Semitic. He put up $40 million for a Jewish museum. He meets regularly with the chief rabbi of Russia once a month. He's let the Jews go wherever they want to go. Made it clear that if they get promoted, that's fine by him. And it all turned out that we learned something stunning about Vladimir Putin, which is hard to imagine, that he was a troubled youth. Well, you know, when somebody's showing off as much as he is, gotta have had some trouble. And his problem was he didn't get along with his parents. You're in shock. He grew up in St. Petersburg. And so there was a woman living on the corner who was, I think, a principal in a high school. And she took him in and kind of helped raise him. And she was actually Orthodox Jewish. And so when he went to Israel for the first time in 2005, he did something I've never heard of anyone else doing as a foreigner. He went and bought an apartment for her for $300,000. And then when she died, she just died. She was like 85 years old. He now is going to have to figure out what he's going to do. So he's got a place if he's got to run real fast. So what's powerful is that Putin is one thing many people are ignoring when they look at the Middle East is that Putin has to weigh this against the importance of if the Labour Party comes to victory in England. That's a huge scoop because I can't think except in the world wars that the Russians and the British ever got along very well. One was terrific in terms of marine power and the other land power. So that's one important point that he looks out and he sees, you know, for the first time, really in 100 years, Russia is liked by more countries. The flip side of that, you've already figured. They don't like us. But it's both the smaller countries, the Hungarians, the Romanians, the Bulgarians. I went to Bulgaria. I thought I was in Moscow on a small scale. They had the same cobblestone streets. They had the same religious, you know, taking up a block. They had the same attitude. And if you ask Bulgars, you know, what do you think of Russia? We love Russia. We love because it's 1878 again. And he could freed us from whom? Turkey. I don't know. These guys know everything. I can retire now. So what's powerful that people need to keep in mind is that people are weighing both ways. And if you want to ask which country has gone the most distance in trying to work Vladimir Putin, Bibi Netanyahu has his faults, no doubt about it, but who doesn't? But what's powerful is he has now made 7 trips to Moscow and to Crimea in the last year and a half. He knows what he's doing. He's paying obeisance. Obeisance or obeisance? He's just saying to him, look, we're not weak ourselves. We can fight Iran, but this isn't good for us, and it's not good for you. It's not good for us because hundreds, thousands of people will probably die in that whole process. The Middle East will go up in flames. You Russians have an opportunity here. If you pull back some of your support, we're not saying you've got to give it all up, but pull back. Why do you want to be with Iran? Because in the long run, Iran wants this to be their region. And they've made that very clear. It's the Persian Empire. There's no Russian word in there. And the same thing with other parts. Lebanon. Lebanon once was an area that was really quasi-democratic, the most advanced people who were down in Saudi Arabia or places that hit 140 degrees in the sun in the summer would come to Lebanon. Now they go to England to get away from it all. So where are we? We need to recognize that it's more complicated. We haven't even gotten into some of the smaller groups. But what's powerful about this is that it's going to come to an end soon. And we have a leader in Bashar Assad, we haven't talked about him in Syria, who seems to be lost. But he's lost for a reason. Anybody know why we say that about Bashar al-Assad? He wasn't meant to be a politician. He didn't study politics or government. What did he study in London? Ophthalmology. Now, maybe ophthalmologists make a bad joke and see things clearer than the rest of us, but what's powerful is his brother was the one that Hafez al-Assad wanted to take his place. Anybody know what happened to his brother? He what? Yeah, and was it an accident? This is Syria, you know, and we're talking about the heir apparent. So there is a real feeling that he was murdered. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But the bottom line is that Syria has seen, how many civilians have been killed in Syria since this war started? 500,000. Excellent. 500,000 people slaughtered for no apparent reason. Bashar al-Assad can do whatever he wants. He's not going to get the most of Syria back. They hate him deeply for all that he has allowed. And what you can see is why it's so confusing to make flat statements about what's going to happen in the Middle East. If I had to make a guess, just a guess, I think for Bashar al-Assad, it's not just about the Israelis. I think it's also about he wants us to have a commanding presence. And the final point about that is that there's also a relationship between Turkey and Iran, but is a very bad relationship between the two countries that used to have empires in the region. One of them is flamingly Shiite, and the other one is just as determinedly Sunni, so referring to the Iranians and the Turks. One has liked the West, not in the countryside, but you go to Istanbul, you go to Ankara, you'll see that there's a very strong liking because the West has been good to Turkey. It hasn't treated it badly for some of the bad things that they did. For example, what did they do in 1915 that no one wants to talk about? They killed 1 million Armenian Christians. Turks never talk about that. And local Jewish population used to be about 100,000 or more. It is down to 14,000 and going to zero quickly. I wanted to go to services, just for the hell of it. I wanted to see what it was like on a Saturday morning. So I went to the synagogue, 10:20. I figured nobody could be done by 10:20. And there was a guard pacing back and forth with this little, earpiece, making clear, he said, we do not allow foreigners, but for that matter, we don't allow Turks to go there anymore. So we also have a major difference. There's a strong bloc in both countries that likes the West, but Turkey actually, and what would be the defining aspect of the membership that the Turks have that none of the other countries do in the region with the West? NATO. We went to the NATO base. If they want to leave all of this, for what? They're not going to take Iran. Iran is stronger than they are right now. Turkish army is 600,000. It can beat the Kurds. We'll leave it at that. So if you look at just that, without even getting into the secondary aspect of it, it becomes very complex. And now there's one more feature. What about the Russian role, not simply to say the Israelis or some others in the region or the reform movement, but what about the Russian role with regards to the United States? Now, every administration starts off often quite badly because to suddenly become president of the United States, go from just being a citizen who may not even win the election, and even more so, no political background. I mean, he was involved in politics, but not professionally. You can see that in what's going on. But the question is still important for Vladimir Putin. And you could just imagine him saying, I've got 6 more years for those Americans to make up their minds what they're going to do to me if I do X, Y, and Z. And he's waiting to hear. And all this collusion, which we talk about in one way, from their point of view, is nothing but what? If you were Russian and you hear this, and I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong. Let's just say it's going on all the time in the media and with the population. Okay, maybe it's true. Who knows? But if you're Vladimir Putin, what's the message it sends to you? Exactly. How did you say that? Yeah, they're confused. And that may mean that we can go slice off a little place, part of some other country while we're at it. But we would like to know, because regardless of everything, this Turkish and Iranian relationship with Russia is probably almost bound. Doesn't mean it will, but probably isn't going to last, for the final reason. Turks and Iranians don't like each other. First, because of the Shiite-Sunni business. What else? Turks historically have been very pro-Western. The West treated them very well, going back to whom? After the end of the Turkish Empire for over 400 to 700 years in the Middle East, who came to power in Turkey in the 20s? Kemal Atatürk. Atatürk. And he was all about modernization, Westernization. He wanted to shave off the beards and to change the clothes and get Turkey into the West. That still has a lot of appeal in Turkey today. It's not where Tayyip Erdogan wants to go. But here, to show you how complicated the situation is, Tayyip Erdogan keeps going more and more and more to the right. First of all, he's in his 60s, so you don't know. Being a politician is for decades, and that probably doesn't go too well. But it's beyond that. We had an election just a couple months ago in Turkey. What did it show? It was powerful. He lost Ankara. He lost Istanbul, the biggest city there. He lost the third largest city in Turkey as well. And what vote did he get? And that's with probable corruption? 51%. That means the Turkish people are used to semi-democracy. They're used to participating economically. It's not. So, and he is very powerful on Islam. We're not trying to say Islam is bad or good, but he is very strong on the need to stop this working together with the West. Whereas when you saw hundreds of thousands of people from the countryside come out, they were saying, but who do we sell things to? Where do we learn technologically? So ever since the 1920s to 38 when he died, and then subsequently, the army has always represented the ideas of a pro-Western state to be part of NATO. And you have to remember, to us, so they're part of NATO, who the hell cares? You have to remember something. Almost no third world country is a part of NATO. NATO is overwhelmingly the EU and the United States. That's something that for a large part of the Turkish elite, that's why Tayyip Erdogan did what he did in that coup, which may have been false or not false, but to take 120,000 people with all of their names ready and drive them out of office, that tells me something. There's a lot of Turks that like the situation that they were in. So what does it all mean? It means that the situation is very complicated for yet another reason. The Turks have historically gotten along reasonably well with the Israelis. And in fact, if you had asked 5 years ago, they would have told you, what is the number one place that Israelis go for vacation? 400,000 a year go to Turkey. It's the number one place. Not America. America's too far. But Turkey is only an hour or two away. So all of this means that whoever tells you we've got the answer and definitely the answer probably isn't right. If you had a guess, all of this will come into play because the military was stifled, which was typically pro-Western in three major coups. They wanted to continue the relationship. They see being in NATO as very important. So it's a matter of Westernism. It's a matter of whether they're part of NATO. And there's one other thing that they're not similar. In other words, the Turks still have NATO despite what's going on, and the Iranians don't. And what else? No? Okay. So we'll wrap up. So what we're trying to say is the final point here is the Turks are not likely to give up on NATO. And as long as they at least meet minimal requirements, the West doesn't want them either because they want that base. So part of the Middle East. So both sides are likely to do that. And when Tayyip Erdogan goes, or, you know, they see what a difference this makes. And that is the final point, that if you're too hostile, you also can lose a great deal. And what you can lose is those economic relationships, which are so powerful. Now, if you're China, you can do all sorts of things, you know, pay all sorts of money and take over Western companies and so forth. But they can't do that if you're in Iran or you're in Turkey. And they are very much in the third world. One's $7,000 GNP per capita, the other is 10. So where are we? We're at an important point. And I had that from a personal experience, which drove it home very well. In the 1980s, I was teaching a course about Russia and China in graduate school in Denver. And two of the people, just a little older than the students, they were probably in their late 30s, came up to me and said, do you want to have lunch with us? Well, that immediately told me they weren't students because they'd have to pay for it. So I said, sure. And they said, how'd you like to work for us? And I said, who am I working for? Oh, well, you're working for a consulting company, but actually you're working for the Defense Department. So we first have to vet you and do all of that kind of stuff. I'll tell you at the end why I can tell you this. And so we spent 8 years. I worked half-time for them. They had 58 people working on, this was in the 1980s, how the Soviet Union will fight World War III. We had 100,000 pieces of paper and articles and assignments. We read all of that. We talked to Russians who come to the United States. And then at the end of that, in 1988, when things began to get much better between, you know, Washington and Moscow, we went to the Soviet Union. And we realized something, that despite all the paper, all the time, all the money, we were dead wrong. We looked at it, and we even wrote back and said, this is not a threat. This country doesn't even have enough to eat. This country doesn't make any kind of clothing. It doesn't make anything that's consumer goods are sold. When you go in to the in the Hotel Kiev, you want to go into a Russian hotel, they have literally nothing that they can sell you. They just tell you, okay, what you got to do is go for a place for foreigners. And you're foreigners, which we accepted. So we all trundled over to a place for foreigners. And there it was. I always grew up a little unusual. Just loved to go shopping. My mother didn't have any daughters, so she said, you're coming. I was 8 years old. Ever since, I've loved it. Like I loved my mother. So, you know, it was great. So I was thinking, wow, this is great. Russia, this is going to be first rate. So as we approached the store that's labeled only for foreigners, right there in front of us was it. The number one thing that a foreigner wants to get and to buy in Russia, 100 rolls of toilet paper. And on that positive note, that means we've got to be careful. You can think we've done everything. And then the people in the Defense Department came and said, 1989, you can tell everybody about what you did. It's okay, because it all came to naught. And that was all that we did.